case, 11AP, 2774, Attorney's Title Guarantee Fund, Inc. versus Town Bank. Arguing on behalf of Heartland Wisconsin Corporation is Attorney David H. Hutchinson. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Dave Hutchinson, and I represent Heartland Wisconsin Corp. in this action. Also in court today is Scott Blair, who is the president of Heartland Wisconsin Corp. Heartland is here today asking this court to reverse the published opinion issued by the Court of Appeals in this case. This case raises two fundamental issues relating to the appropriate reach and application of Wisconsin's common law receiver's lien that a judgment creditor acquires in the process of pursuing supplementary proceedings against a judgment debtor. The Court of Appeals in this case ruled that Wisconsin Statute 816.08 provides a statutory basis for extending a judgment creditor's common law receiver's lien to attach to personal property acquired by a judgment debtor years after the supplementary proceedings have concluded. The court so ruled in spite of the fact that the word lien is found nowhere in Section 816.08. And as this court observed in the Badger Lines case, the word lien is found nowhere in Chapter 816. And it is for that reason that this court has previously ruled that a receiver's lien in Wisconsin is strictly a common law concept. In addition, the Court of Appeals in this case ruled that a judgment creditor has no obligation to make a public record of his post-judgment collection actions in the form of a proceeding with supplementary proceedings in front of a court commissioner, in spite of the fact that Section 816.035 precisely states that if a judgment creditor chooses to proceed with supplementary proceedings in front of a court commissioner, then in that event, the court commissioner order directing the judgment debtor to appear and the proof of service shall be filed in the court file. In our case, in spite of the fact that there was no such filing, the Court of Appeals ruled that Town Bank nonetheless had a valid receiver's lien.
Okay, can I? Sure. I just interrupt you so I can try to understand and keep in mind the facts, right?
Okay.
And what how they affect the legal issue.
Okay.
And you know we have a case that we're going to hear this afternoon that also involves a creditor's lien.
Right.
So, and the facts are different, right? And in this case, this judgment was docketed, right?
Correct.
No problem. What was not properly done, according to the statutes, was, as you just stated, that the order for an appearance of Brophy and proof of service were not filed.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And whose obligation under the statute was it to file proof of service and the order to appear?
Well, as I'm sure you understand, the statute itself says the supplemental commissioner shall file the order and the return with the clerk of the court in which the judgment involved is entered.
Yeah, and I make that because it seems to me that the arguments go to, I make this point, stress this, because your arguments go to, and so does opposing counsel, go to this defect.
That's correct.
Right?
That's correct.
And the question is this defect enough to defeat your lien? Right?
It's enough to defeat the lien of the judgment creditor.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And in contrast, in the Badger Lines case,
uh-huh.
the Not only was the court order to Badger Lines to appear for the supplementary proceeding filed, as is required by the statute, but also there was a receiver's appointment order that was filed and also a turnover order that was filed. In Badger Lines, all three orders were filed. In our case, there was no such filing of any kind. In Badger Lines, this court ruled that where we have all three orders that have been filed, the court order to the judgment that are to turn over property and the order requiring the receiver to be appointed were not more public in nature than the order to the judgment debtor initially to appear. There was nothing filed. Our case is quite distinguishable on the facts.
Okay, and I just want to get to the other issue, as I understand it in the case.
Okay.
Is that the question, what does any property mean? Right?
That's correct.
All right. And why is that important?
Well, in our case, the Court of Appeals ruled that Section 816.08 is a statutory basis for extending this common law lien. And our view is that what the Court of Appeals did was they took just part of the language of Section 816.08 and ignored the rest. Now, the court relied on this language in 816.08, the Court of Appeals. It states, the court or judge may order any property of the judgment debtor or due to the judgment debtor, not exempt from execution, to be applied toward the satisfaction of the judgment. And that's where the Court of Appeals ended. The Court of Appeals ignored the rest of the statute, stating, the rest of the statute states, but if it appeared that any person alleged to have property of the judgment debtor or to be indebted to the judgment debtor claims an adverse interest in the property or denies the debt, such interest or debt shall be recoverable only in an action against such person by the receiver, and a transfer or other disposition of such property or interest may be restrained till a sufficient opportunity be given to the receiver to commence the action and prosecute the same to judgment and execution, or until security, therefore, shall be given as ordered. The receiver referred to in the statute is a receiver appointed pursuant to 816.04 of the supplementary proceeding statutes. In fact, I think this court in the Milwaukee MAC case, Department of Revenue versus Milwaukee MAC, specifically referred to the fact that in that case, the receiver representing, in that case, the Department of Revenue was appointed pursuant to 816.04. And what was being construed in Milwaukee MAC was the length of time that the receiver, after being appointed pursuant to 816.04, could pursue an action against Milwaukee MAC thereafter. And this court ruled that given a six-month hiatus between being restrained, having the issuance of a restraining order, and where the receiver did not pursue any subsequent separate action against Milwaukee MAC, then in that event there was no further possible interest that the receiver could pursue. The supplementary proceedings are summary in nature, and there has never been a case where this court or any court in the state has previously ruled that notwithstanding the summary nature of supplementary proceedings, there is nevertheless this general receiver's lien that extends out into the future, particularly in our situation where there was no filing whatsoever that would indicate to anyone looking at the court file that the supplementary proceedings had even occurred.
Counselor, I want to talk to you a little bit about filing. As part of the record, there is a financing statement that Heartland filed in regard to the assignment of the proceeds from the malpractice claim, correct?
Correct.
And you did that in accord with Chapter 409 of the Wisconsin statutes, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so is Heartland then a secured creditor with regard to these proceeds from the malpractice action?
Yes, that's my position.
Okay, well, if they're a secured creditor in regard to these proceeds, how does that interest arising under 409 line up with your opponent's claim that they have a common law lien or a lien arising under Chapter 816? I'm not sure which they're really arguing, or maybe both. How does that line up in regard to priority to these proceeds?
Our position that they cannot have a receiver's lien that extends years into the future after the conclusion of their supplementary proceedings in March of 2006. There has never been a case in the state of Wisconsin where this court has so ruled. Moreover, any possible lien they could have had, they've lost by virtue of not making a public record of their asserted common law lien.
So essentially you're arguing they don't have a lien for these proceeds. But if they did have a lien, your lien is superior.
Our position is they do not have a lien, mm-hmm. period, plain and simple.
Well, they were first, right? They got a judgment first, and they docketed the judgment first before you came into the picture, right?
That's correct.
In February 2006. And in March 2006, they had supplementary proceedings. But there was a goof. There was a goof. That they did the summons, the order was not filed, and the service was not filed. That was contrary to statute. Therefore, it's your position they don't have a lien.
That's correct.
They don't have a common law lien.
That's my position.
All right. Your second position, supplemental, is okay, if they had a lien, it wasn't any good except for property that was in existence and they found through the supplementary proceeding. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, I understand your position. And if you're right about your position, then they had, even if they did have a good judgment lien or creditor's lien, common law, it didn't go to the property you have a secured interest in.
That's precisely correct.
That's precisely your position.
Right.
And so it will rise or fall on the concept of whether failure to file by the clerk defeats your opponent. Doesn't it rise and fall on that?
It is also our position that a receiver's lien in Wisconsin.
Was there a receiver in this case?
No.
Go ahead.
In the Badger Lines case, this court, because a receiver was appointed, Doug Mann was appointed in that case, the court said, well, you know, it could be a creditor's lien, could be called a receiver's lien. There was no receiver appointed in this case, but I'm using the term generally as a receiver's lien. It's our position that a receiver's lien attaches to property discovered in the course of the supplementary proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't...
No after acquired property.
It doesn't go on particularly years into the future after the conclusion of the supplementary proceedings.
And when did this property interest in the unpaid legal fees arise? Because I couldn't find that in the record.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch it.
When does the property interest in unpaid legal fees, the malpractice, that which you have a security interest in, when did that arise?
Unpaid legal fees.
There was a counterclaim filed by Timothy Brophy against Harvey Goldstein, I believe in February of 2007.
Right, but Goldstein sued Brophy for unpaid legal fees.
That's correct.
Right? But counterclaim for malpractice.
Right.
Okay, February 2007.
We took an assignment of the counterclaim in the summer of 2007. The counterclaim was filed in February of 2007, and it was in existence at that time. And the assignment was with respect to possible proceeds that could be obtained from that counterclaim.
And there's no, is there an issue in this case as to whether your assignment was any good?
No, our assignment has never been contested.
Okay.
Mr. Hutchinson, is there not some significance to the fact that Town Bank in August of 2009 brought a motion asking for appointment of a receiver and asking that the receiver be granted authority to settle in regard to the Goldstein case? According to the timeline that I'm looking at, the settlement occurred in September of 2009, after those motions were made. Isn't that significant at all?
The motions were never heard, and there was an agreement to transfer the funds to the escrow agent to be held pending the determination here. My view is that if Town Bank was going to pursue those settlement proceeds, Town Bank would have had to have done that in March of 2006, discovering them in the context of the supplementary proceedings in March of 2006.
They weren't discovered in 2006.
They weren't. That's correct. But there was a pending counterclaim as of February of 2007, which was then the proceeds of which were then assigned to Heartland.
And it's your position if Town Bank wanted to get those proceeds, they would have had to have another supplementary proceeding and file it properly in order to beat you out, right? Because it's your position, if I understand it, that only the property discovered at the supplementary gets the lien.
I did not catch it.
Only the property discovered at the supplementary gets the lien.
Right.
Was every creditor required to have a supplementary? What if you know what someone's assets are?
Well,
you don't
necessarily
need one, right?
I think you could. They could have. The question is whether or not there's a lien. Clearly, if Town Bank was interested in pursuing these settlement proceeds and they did not have a lien as of September of 2009, they could have possibly sought some way to execute upon the proceeds. There are alternatives to judgment creditors for collecting on judgments other than merely receivers and receivers' liens. The question in this case is,
I guess I always thought of a supplementary as kind of like a discovery tool.
Precisely.
Where I don't know where your assets are. I don't want you hiding them from me, so you are going to be under oath and you're going to tell me where I can get the money, right? But you don't have to have a supplementary proceeding in order to have a valid lien, right?
They have a valid lien? Right. Here's the difference, and you raise a very good point. In Wisconsin, there's a statute on judgment liens that relates to real property, and that's section 806.15. And that statute basically says that if a judgment is properly docketed in the judgment and lien roll in the circuit court, then that judgment shall constitute a lien on all the real property of the judgment debtor in that county. And that lien shall exist for the next 10 years. Moreover, that same docketed judgment will be a lien on any new property acquired by the judgment debtor within that same 10-year period. That only relates to real property. There is no such statute such as that with respect to personal property. The only type of lien, that can be obtained, as I understand it, in personal property is in the event that a receiver's lien gets attached to property at the time of the supplementary proceeding.
Why do you think there is a lien that attaches at the time of the supplementary proceeding? Why do you think a lien arises?
I think if you look at the cases and try to synthesize the cases and the other cases that this court referred to in Badger Lines the, quote, older three cases of Alexander, Kellogg, and Holton. In each of those cases, the question of whether or not the receiver's lien or who had first had a receiver's lien was in the context where there were competing judgment creditors going after assets of the judgment debtor. And in each of those three older cases, there was a receiver appointed. So it was clear that the assets were discovered during the course of the supplementary proceedings. And my understanding is that it is to determine whether there are competing judgment creditors, who's first, and it depends on who first gets served. And of course, that is it presumes.
I'm sorry, I want to stop you just a minute. I'm going looking at Badgerland, paragraph 10, and I know you don't have it in front of you. Paragraph 11 in Badgerline, okay? And it says, and the court is speaking here, we view this as an issue between two unsecured judgment creditors, okay? So you're talking about the trustee in bankruptcy and Emerald.
Right.
Emerald was a judgment creditor by virtue of the judgment that was duly docketed. The trustee in bankruptcy is a judgment creditor by virtue of federal statute that gives him that status, okay? So that's what they're talking about, is two unsecured creditors, okay? So if they're unsecured creditors, I don't believe the question of whether they had a lien was ever decided in Badgerland, because the court was never asked to decide it. The court was asked to decide whether the judgment was perfected, because under bankruptcy law, that had to do with whether or not the trustee in bankruptcy could avoid it and make it unsecured. Okay? So that was a federal bankruptcy question. But we never decided whether a common law lien arises by the serving of an order to appear for supplemental. The court was never asked to do that.
Well, I understood that Douglas Mann, as a receiver, acquired a receiver's lien that attached to the property that was discovered in the supplementary examination in that case. That he was able to keep the trustee in bankruptcy wasn't able to have that brought back into the...
It was... The parties didn't argue about that. The parties agreed, okay, that he had a lien. But the court didn't address the issue. You can read the cases again and again. I've probably read it 16 times before today. It's not an issue that the court was asked to decide. The parties talked about the receiver's lien, but the court was not asked to decide that issue. And the way you're arguing this to me is you're assuming, first of all, that this case is on parallel track with Badgerline. Here, we have a judgment creditor who may or may not have a lien, okay? And we have a secured creditor under Chapter 409. In Badgerline, you had two unsecured creditors. That's what the court said in its opinion. So I'm a little mystified by the way you're focusing your argument and that you're not arguing to me, hey, we're secured. We have security in this under Chapter 409. We filed our financing statement. If you give them priority, you're going to read out of the whole statutes the whole Chapter 409. Well, that's what it's there for. We gave notice. You're not showing that to me. Why not?
It's our position they have no lien whatsoever because they never discovered this.
I understand that's your position. But I think that there are a number of positions that you could be taking, and I'm wondering why are you not taking a stronger position under Chapter 409?
Well, we certainly are a secured, perfected secured party.
I know, and you put the financing statement in the record. That's how I have it.
I think that is the only legitimate interest that attaches to these settlement proceeds, plain and simple.
Okay.
All right. What's the difference between, let's take a receiver, a lien, and a secured creditor?
A secured creditor is recognized as a secured party under 409 in the Wisconsin.
They have a kind of lien, right?
They have a security interest by statute that gets perfected by filing a financing statement.
Well, and what it means is when things go south, they want to get paid first.
That's correct.
Right. And a lien, creditor's lien or receiver's lien, has the same connotation. That is, they've got a line, a hook, on the property, and if things go south, and they can't get paid from something else, but they don't have to look for someplace else, they get paid first. Isn't that the point?
If they have a lien.
If they have a lien. So, and...
But it's clearly our position that...
I know.
Town
they don't, because once you say they have a lien, they're ahead of you, if not by months, at least a year.
I think by law, they don't have a
lien. Pardon me? I know. I understand your position. But if they did have a lien, you have a tougher argument because they are ahead of you in time.
If so, they acquired that lien legitimately in March
that's
of
right.
2006.
That's right. And you aren't in the picture until after that.
We obtained an assignment of the possible proceeds in the summer of 2007. And the red light has gone on.
I understand that. And then, of course, in Badger Lines, the court discusses at great length cases that deal with the lien that arises as a result of supplemental proceedings. Right?
All of those cases involved a discovery of assets in the course of the supplementary proceedings.
Right. So you could distinguish them and say you fit right within it and that there was no property here
right.
in which you have a secured interest
right.
at the time of the supplementary.
And if you look back at the Milwaukee Mac case, which I'm sure this justice is aware of, where the receiver did not pursue, the receiver for the Department of Revenue did not pursue any additional action against Milwaukee Mac within a six-month period, this court clearly ruled that there was no further interest on the part of the Department of Revenue in that case.
You know, we didn't have time to discuss the issue of statutory interpretation and that the words any property are very broad words, so perhaps you might approach that issue on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Sorry, Justice Prosser would like to... Justice Prosser has a question.
Could I ask some extremely elementary questions? When you have when a creditor has a judgment and has not proceeded to any supplementary proceeding, let's suppose that the judgment debtor wins the lottery. What is the judgment creditor's rights toward those lottery proceeds?
I think they could start a non-earnings garnishment action. They could attempt to have the sheriff execute on the lottery proceeds. There's a number of alternatives.
They can bring a supplemental and get a lien.
Right. If they get a lien.
At that moment.
If that's legitimate.
That's the law.
There's no lien.
There's no lien on future property, and there is a lien on real property, not personal property.
And there's no lien unless you bought a supplemental. Isn't that your position?
There cannot be a lien unless there's a supplemental.
Okay.
Now it's our position in this case, there is no lien.
In my hypothetical, there's the judgment, and then the judgment creditor goes to a supplementary proceeding before the lottery is won. Does that change the judgment creditor's rights at all?
No.
And that's because you're saying that the lottery is not the property at the time of the supplementary proceeding.
That's correct. But that's not to say that the judgment creditor couldn't, upon learning of the lottery, attempt to garnish and the like. He just won't have a lien.
I understand.
And that's also presuming, I mean, you also have to go through the steps of giving public record notice that they've even done a supplementary by having the court commissioner order and proof of service filed.
Okay. Now, with respect to this case, the claim... The malpractice claim, is that any different from the future lottery winnings?
I don't believe so.
Okay, and is that an essential issue that we have to decide?
I'm not. In this case, the counterclaims weren't filed as of March of 2006. They weren't in existence. And they weren't, even if they had, you know, there was no discovery of the potential of these malpractice claims during the course of the supplementary examination in February or March of 2006. I guess if they had thought that there were legitimate malpractice claims at that time, Town Bank could have asked the court commissioner to appoint a receiver, and the receiver could have pursued the malpractice claims, but none of that occurred.
Okay. If you prevail on this sort of future property, it's not covered, then the importance of the notice isn't so critical. Is that right?
That's correct.
You can prevail on either point.
Right.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. David, Attorney David Cesar, representing Town Bank.
Court. My name is David Cesar of the firm of Andreessen and Roper, appearing on behalf of Town Bank this morning. I would first like to address a couple of questions that were raised, and then I'd like to make 4 points about why Heartland is wrong on the first issue, and 2 points about why it is wrong on the second issue. And the first clarification I want to make arises out of the question asked by Justice Rogensack, and it was also touched on by Chief Justice Abramson. The question was, what's the relationship, really, what establishes the relationship between creditor's lien, I'll call it, Town Bank's creditor's lien in this case, and the UCC security interest or the UCC filing that was made by Heartland long after they took their assignment, was not made by Heartland until after the Chapter 11 bankruptcy was dismissed in 2009, 2 years after they made their loan. There's a statutory answer to that. It's very clear. The statute is cited on page 18 of our brief in this case. It's 409.317.1b1. And it says, it defines, first of all, 409.102.1MS defines lien creditor, which is what we are in this case. It's a creditor who has acquired a lien on property involved by attachment, levy, or the like. And then, at the bottom of page 18 and top of page 19.
Attachment, levy, or the like.
Correct.
You didn't attach it, and you didn't levy it, so what's the or like?
The like is the service of the order of the peer.
So that's what you're hanging your hat on. Okay.
Yes, and that is the consensus of the commentators. We cited a couple of cases, I think, in our Court of Appeals brief, and we cited two secondary sources, Article 9 sources. But the priority is set forth in Section 409.317.1b1, which says a security interest is subordinate to the rights of a person that becomes a lien creditor before the security interest is perfected. Therefore, the Heartland security interest wasn't perfected until 2009 after the Chapter 11 was dismissed. We perfected our creditor's lien pursuant to the requirements of this court in the Badger Lines case when we served the order to appear in February of 2006. That is how Article 9 fits together with the concept of a judicial lien.
Okay, so I understand what you're saying. And so by giving this, quote, judicial lien, the court really knocks out all of Chapter 409 for anybody that wants to do business with someone once there's been a judgment and that judgment creditor has done a supplemental. So for the rest of that person's commercial lifetime, nobody can have a secured transaction with that person because you will always be ahead.
That's
right?
Correct. That's correct.
You really think that's correct? That you can just knock out a whole section of the statutes?
Well, yes, because that's what the statute says.
Well, the statute says that, but you are putting in, or the like, what you believe is a lien that I assume you think, from your brief, arises out of Badger Line. But Badger Line, the court never decides whether they have a lien. It's assumed there is a lien. Right? And if you read Badger Line, the court talks about two unsecured creditors. Well, if one had a lien, wouldn't that creditor be secured, at least in regard to the property that they were discussing?
I'm trying to remember the facts.
A judgment creditor.
Yes, it was a judgment creditor and the trustee in that case. Yes, I'm not going to disagree with that. In this case, though, there's a claim that there's a UCC security interest, and the relationship has to be, you're correct that the issue of when the lien arose wasn't precisely before the court in Badger Lines. It was before the district court. Originally, there were four or five Badger Lines cases. The district court decided it, and it went back down, decided on the first issues that went up. The question was, when does the lien arise? And it is clear in that case that was not the issue that went up on the second. The second issue, and the only issue, I would say, that was argued in the trial court and in the court of appeals in this case was the perfection issue. The existence of the lien was never doubted or questioned.
It was never questioned in Badger Line that the receiver that was appointed and operating had a lien. The court was not asked to decide whether the receiver had a lien.
I think that was an issue, not in this court, correct. It was in the district court, in the earlier district court decisions in the Badger Lines case. It first went up to the district court out of the bankruptcy court on that issue. I believe it's also addressed in other cases in this court. I believe Candy versus Egan says that the lien arises upon service of the order to appear. What was the issue in this case was, is there anything in addition to getting the lien that has to be done, or what in addition to getting the lien has to be done in order to perfect the lien? And the court clearly answered it, it's service of the order to appear before the court commissioner. So that's the first issue that I want to be very clear on. And again, that was not an issue that arose in this case.
Counsel, your position is you've got a lien, right?
Yes.
All right. And why do you have a lien?
We have a lien because we serve the order to appear.
A common law lien.
Common law judicial lien, correct.
Which you're relying on this case law that recognizes thee as a common law lien.
Yes.
All right. And the fact that the clerk didn't, I have to be careful about my words, and didn't file this service in the order that he appear does not, in your opinion, I gather, affect the validity of the lien. Is that right?
That's correct.
Why not?
Because that's what this court said in the Badger Lines case. The Badger Lines case said that nothing more than service of the order to appear needs to be done, and it said that that's when really essentially perfection occurs. And nothing, not only does it say that, it says nothing more needs to be done.
Where exactly is that language?
It's in the last part of the decision.
Paragraph 27. Maybe?
Yes, I believe that's correct. I think it's the second from the last paragraph.
That's 27. Aside from the fact that this court does not find this trustee's secret lien argument persuasive, we also conclude the policy interest is served by holding that no additional step is necessary to perfect a receiver's lien after service. That's your language.
Yes.
All right. Well, you know, this is all equity, as I understand it, right?
Yeah. Well,
this whole concept of liens.
If I may, I am inferring that your opposing counsel's position is that because documents were not taken to the clerk's office, they simply lacked any notice about the supplementary proceeding. Is that fair?
Well, actually, that's not my position.
No, your opponent.
Yes, it's as if there's a condition subsequent to what this court said is required that has to be maintained in order to maintain the lien, which doesn't make any sense to me.
Did they have any notice?
Did they have any notice? According to this court in Badger Lines, yes, they did, because the judgment was of record, and they could have called the judgment creditors and asked them about it, and they could have talked to the debtor about it, and they were on notice by virtue of the existence of the judgment itself, and they should have made inquiry as to whether or not an order to appear had been served, and that is very clear from the case. And when that decision was announced in 1999, it was clarity to the bar and to creditors and to the bar. So that question has been clearly answered, I believe, by this court in the Badger Lines case.
Do you agree that the judgment alone did not provide a lien to your client?
Well, I believe that on the status of the law right now, it's the service of the order to appear, as well as that creates the lien as well as perfects the lien.
Okay.
So you need a supplemental.
No.
Okay. How do you get the order to the notice and the order and the service without a supplemental?
Well, you serve the order to appear. In this case, we did take a supplemental exam, but you do not need to. I don't think you do need to take the supplemental exam in order to have the lien and perfect the lien.
How do you do it?
And if I may, I'd like to address why this court has already answered.
All right. Before you do that, if I heard Justice Pross's question correctly, he said when the clerk doesn't have the order to appear in the service, and that was the premise of his question, but maybe, again, I'm always worried about confusing these two cases in my mind, didn't you give the clerk the order and the notice of service?
No, we
file.
Did not.
You did not.
No, we did not. Our position, Chief Justice Abramson, is that was the duty of the court commissioner, and furthermore, the filing of the order to, of the service of the order to appear, it just is physically impossible to do that before you serve it. And perfection of the judicial lien has already taken place under Badger Lines upon service order to appear, before it gets filed with the court commissioner, even if it got filed.
Let me ask this. Because the supplementary commissioner didn't turn certain documents over to the clerk's office, Heartland, if they'd gone to the clerk's office, wouldn't have found anything. Is that right?
They would not have found the service of the order to appear.
If they looked at CCAP, they wouldn't have found anything.
But they would have seen the judgment.
What you're saying is that Heartland should have called Town Bank and said, well, even though we hadn't found anything, did you get a lien?
That's not only what we're saying, Your Honor, Justice Prosser. That's what this court said in the Badger Lines case. And there are good.
Is that fair?
Yes, it is. It is fair, and this court has ruled and this will be my first of 4 points of why the court should uphold the Court of Appeals on that issue. The court has already ruled in the Badger Lines case that the policy behind not requiring more than service of the order to appear for perfection is the desire to encourage negotiation before tearing apart and liquidating the debtor. If the lien does not extend to all non-exempt assets, including both after-acquired assets, and undiscovered assets, negotiation will similarly be chilled because the creditor will need to move directly to appoint a receiver and liquidate a going business before the discovered or existing inventory flies off the shelves, or the discovered or existing accounts receivable are spent and replaced by new, previously not existing, or undiscovered accounts or other property that were not perfected in because they either weren't in existence or weren't discovered. The assets of a debtor, especially a business debtor, are changing all the time. A rule that permits perfection to depend upon discovered or existing assets is simply impractical. And this is in paragraph 27 of the Badger Lines case, where the court makes two policy decisions. Number one, we shouldn't tear apart the debtor before there's some negotiation about how this lien can be satisfied. And the second one is, in that same area of the case, we shouldn't waste judicial resources trying to figure out what we have here, because that's what we would have in this case if the Heartland's...
Counselor, I want to interrupt you a minute. I have a hypothetical that goes to your position that you're hanging your hat on service of this order. Once you do that, you figure you got a lien, and that establishes your right to this property, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
This is a hypothetical. Okay, if Mr. B gets a judgment against the debtor, on the same day, he serves a supplemental order, okay? And Mr. A, who has a prior judgment against the debtor, doesn't serve a supplemental order, but executes against property that he knows that judgment debtor has, does he have to turn over everything he collects to Mr. B, who has a subsequent judgment, even though he's prior docketed, because he chooses execution rather than choosing a supplemental exam to proceed on the debt? Because if you have a lien, then you're ahead of him on the property the sheriff executes against.
If the execution occurs after the service of the order to appear, that is my position.
Okay, so what you would be doing is you would be superseding a prior judgment by serving an order, and the execution then, the whole execution in Chapter 815 is now going to fly out of the statutes because it's not useful by someone who has a duly docketed judgment once you serve that supplemental, right?
That is our position, Your
Honor. Even if they had a prior judgment,
it's useful in this respect, as was noted also in the Badger Lines case. What's supposed to happen is the second creditor is supposed to talk to the first creditor.
Yeah, but he serves a supplemental. Why would he want to talk? He's going to serve a supplemental. He can jump ahead of someone who has lien priority by virtue of the date of docketing. Why would he want to bother talking to him? All he has to do is serve a supplemental, and he gets to take whatever anybody collects, even if the other guy does the collection efforts.
I'm sorry. Perhaps I misunderstood the question. The first creditor serves the order to appear. Is that right?
Okay.
And then the second creditor executes?
The first creditor has a judgment that's docketed after the one that serves the supplemental has a judgment that's docketed after the first judgment creditor. Okay, so Mr. A dockets his judgment first. Mr. B dockets his judgment second, but he serves a supplemental. Mr. A gets an order from the court to have the sheriff go out and sell assets that he knows he owns. Okay, so my question to you was, if you have a lien on all those assets once you serve the order, then the execution isn't going to benefit Mr. A. And your answer to me was right. He would have to have a prior interest by virtue of the service of the order.
Well, I think that's the issue of the next case, really not our case, because both the docketing and the service of the order to appear occurred.
No, it's the issue in this case. It's the issue in every case where you're going to have a lien that lives on forever, whether you were first or not to docket your judgment simply by serving an order. That's your position, right? You serve the order, you get a lien on personal property.
It would be my position on the current state of the law that it would last as long as the judgment lasts, yes.
Okay.
And there's nothing right. inequitable
but,
about that.
But you see what happens when you have someone who has a prior docketed judgment, and instead of choosing to do a supplemental exam and serving an order, they execute against the property. Or maybe they do a garnishment because they know where there's property. You would step ahead of them by simply serving the order, even though you docketed your judgment later.
Okay. Now, no. Well, again, I'm not sure I understand. If it may be the case, I know that when a garnishment is served, that gives rise to a lien itself under the common law. Mm-hmm. So if
we're just saying, say you just execute, get an order from the judge and send the sheriff out.
Right. It may be the case, I'm not sure, that the execution gives rise to an execution lien also. And if the execution is served before the order to appear is served, then the execution lien may...
What if the execution is done the day after the order to serve? You still shut down all the avenues of collection for someone who has a prior docketed judgment by simply serving the notice to appear for a supplemental.
Correct, Your Honor. That is our position.
But, you know, I can't understand how that's going to work in a commercial setting.
This is how it works. As was also suggested in or around paragraph 27 of the Badger Lines case, you call up the creditor who got the judgment, and you talk to that creditor, and you find out what the facts are, and then what really happens is if the second creditor wants to go after the debtor, the second creditor says, okay, if I go after him and spend the money to collect the judgment, will you at least let me get my cost of going after it out of it and maybe give me some of the upside? And that's what
don't you think you would shut down secured transactions like occurred here? I mean, if someone made the call you're talking about, do you think Heartland would really have lent $200,000 to solve another lawsuit and take an assignment of a claim knowing you have a prior interest? I mean, the assignment itself says they've not assigned it to anybody else, but if you have a prior lien on it, that transaction is never going to occur. It's never going to occur.
Well, it wouldn't have, and it shouldn't have in this case, because no secured creditor that I worked with in 30 years, seeing $1.6 million judgment out there, is going to make that loan. I don't know what motivated it in this case, but seeing $1.6 million and three or four other things going on out there is going to give rise to a lot of questions, and they're not going to make that loan with that much trouble out there. And commercial creditors. It's rare for commercial creditors to make loans on the strength of causes of action. Now, I want to address, if I may, the
can we get back to Justice Bross's question?
That's exactly where I was.
Okay, fine. Thank you. You may.
Justice Prosser, I believe, asked the question about that went to the malpractice claims in this case. In fact, there is evidence in this case. There was no issue in the lower court as to when the malpractice claims arose, existed. That wasn't an issue in the lower courts. There is evidence in the record in the three pages of the supplementary proceeding that are in the record. It's in Mr. Hutchinson's affidavit where he attached the counterclaim, the malpractice counterclaim. That malpractice counterclaim contains 13 causes of action. One of those causes of action, I think it's the 12th or 13th one, alleges malpractice by the lawyer out of the Town Bank case. So clearly, the malpractice, or at least some of it, arose before the order to appear was served, because it happened in this case. There's reference to a Prospect Avenue property in the malpractice complaint. That had to have occurred before this order to appear was served. So it's not like it's not really like the Justice Prosser's hypothetical
about the lottery,
because it's clear that at least some of the malpractice arose before the order of appear was served. And that also highlights the second of the two policy reasons addressed in the Badger Lines case that this court should apply to this case, too. How are we going to sort out what malpractice occurred before the order to appear was served and what malpractice occurred after the order to appear was served? What a mess that's going to be.
Counsel, I have another question for you on malpractice. You know, this is a commercial tort claim under the UCC. UCC says the state has to decide whether you can actually assign legal malpractice claims. You haven't raised an issue that this wasn't even anything you could assign.
That's true.
Have you thought about that?
I will agree that is a problem.
But it was never brought up in the lower courts. No one ever, opposing counsel said no one ever questioned his assignment. So I'm assuming it was never challenged about whether you could even make such an assignment, which is a question of state law.
I agree that it is. I also agree that it, in this particular context, it probably is a commercial tort claim, and which is why, on an equitable basis, Town Bank also should defeat the Heartland assignment, because they never even the argument is that we did something wrong when we didn't do what the court commissioner was supposed to do by filing the return of the service for the order to appear. Well, Heartland never filed its UCC financing, even if it is assignable, until after 2 years afterwards, when the bankruptcy case was dismissed.
Well, the timing of when they filed it wouldn't have made a lot of difference if it is assignable, because you're saying that your lien runs forevermore, so it doesn't make any difference. You would be underneath them all the way through. You did your supplemental exam more than a year before the assignment.
That's correct. I would like to point out as well, though, that remember, it wasn't too long after we did that there was a bankruptcy that occurred.
Right.
There was a bankruptcy for a year, almost 2 years, I believe. And then when we came out of bankruptcy, then that's when we started dealing with the malpractice causes of action.
Right.
Counsel,
I'm sorry, are you done with answering the question? If not, continue to answer that. I said, if you are finished answering that question, I have another one for you.
Fine, thank you.
Okay. It's my understanding from the record that the commissioner, the supplemental commissioner, had all the necessary papers to file them in the clerk of court's office. Is that right? Or are you at fault for not having in the supplemental commissioner's office?
I do not think we are at fault, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to the first question.
Because as I read your brief, when you got to why it's equitable that you win, one of your arguments was that under the statute, you had no obligation to file those papers with the clerk, that it was under the commissioner's obligation, and that in equity, you go to other remedies first before you grant an equitable remedy.
It is correct that it's our position that we had no obligation to file that return of the service
right.
of the order. But more importantly, that can't be done until after the order is served and the court has already decided that it's all that service is the cutoff. And in addition, this court in the Badger Lines defined the concept of perfection and announced that as from other sources, it's that moment when the creditor has sufficient rights to defeat another creditor who obtains a judicial lien. So if this court were to adopt Heartland's position, you're undermining, if I would say, you would be undermining the definition of perfection that was used in the Badger Lines case.
Now, Badger Lines relied in part
in its analysis with regard to the existence of a lien on three old cases. I think of the 1879 case of Kellogg that talked about lien. It says the general rule was that the creditor who, after filing his bill, obtained the first service of the subpoena upon the judgment debtor, thereby obtained a prior lien upon the equitable assets of such debtor. So this concept of a common law lien has been around for quite some time, it appears to me.
I agree, it has been. And you reminded me, Justice Bradley, that there are cases that do address when the lien arises.
Yes, you responded to Justice Rogan's act with regard to the Candy case, C-A-N-D-E-E, but that's a 1979 case, which stands for the premise this kind of a lien is an equitable creation based on common law. I mean, that's what you cited for 1979, but you can go back to 1879 and talk about these common law.
Yes, I knew it was in prior cases. I couldn't remember others. And I believe it is in Candy as well. The discourse announced that the existence of the lien, and my guess is that's why it wasn't an issue in the Badger Lines case, because the parties essentially thought it was well decided or sufficiently decided.
Would you have had a receiver's lien had Mr. Brophy won the lottery?
If he won the lottery, if he bought the ticket. The question has to be, when does the property interest arise, I suppose, which is why it's not the proceeds of the malpractice claim. It's not when the counterclaim was served. It's when did the claim arise, I suppose. And with the lottery example, I suppose the claim arises when, or the property right arises when you buy the ticket. And if I had served an order to appear before the lottery ticket was purchased, it would be my position that my lien attaches to that lottery ticket. And even if they bought the ticket afterwards, I would say that it does. Again, because of policy reasons announced in this court, in part in the Badger Lines case. How are we going to decide? It would take discovery, pleadings, and hearings to ferret out, shall we say, what was really discovered in the supplementary proceeding, if that's the rule. And I would also say that if that's the rule, that's going to encourage judgment debtors to probably not be too honest, because they can defeat the perfection of the lien by not disclosing it. Far-fetched, perhaps, but possible. The existence of the lien and the perfection of the lien should not depend upon the thoroughness of the examiner or the veracity of the debtor. I submit that letting that be the case does not promote judicial policy.
Counselor, what if he won the lottery 3 years after you served him with the order to appear? You think you still have rights in that that supersede any other creditor's rights?
I'm sorry, the red light is on, but
you may
answer the question. My answer would be yes. Why shouldn't it? We've got our judgment, and that is the purpose of the rule announced by this case when the court defined perfection. That's the purpose of it, to determine that precise point in time when one creditor beats another creditor. And if you were to say that after acquired assets or after discovered assets shouldn't be that, you would be defeating, in part, I think, the concept of perfection as announced by this court. I would also like to add one more point, if I may. If the court, the ruling in Badger Lines was so clear, and we appreciated that, the if this court were to decide to do something or reverse that decision, I would suggest that it would be so inequitable to Town Bank in this particular case that based upon the concept of the sunbursting doctrine, that it should only be prospective. Town Bank, again, I believe, has the equities here because it did everything it was required to do by this court to obtain and perfect its lien. And if this court were to do something to reverse the ruling announced 14 years ago in the Badger Lines case, I would refer the court to the Heritage Farms versus Markle Insurance case, 339 Wisconsin 2nd, a recent case just announced last year, and State versus Picotti, I believe it's pronounced, 261 Wis 2nd, 203. My time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Mr. Hutchinson?
I believe at the end of my initial statements, the Chief Justice asked me to address statutory construction issues. I might note, as this Court is aware and stated in the Crown Castle case, that Chapter 816 largely came about in 1856, I believe, and certainly, Section 816.08 basically was enacted in the 1850s, and no other court in this state has ever ruled that Section 816.08 provides a statutory basis for extending a common law lien, as the Court of Appeals did in this case. In addition, I think if this court would say that it doesn't matter that there was no filing in the court file in this case, then the last provision in Section 816.035 is rendered superfluous. I think that was a problem for the trial judge, Mac Davis, who said, basically, why bother to file a darn thing if it doesn't matter? And frankly, to affirm the Court of Appeals in this case would be essentially rendering the language, making it a mandatory filing that there be a court commissioner order and return filed with the clerk. That provision is superfluous if this court would affirm the Court of Appeals. Now,
can't you sue the commissioner or the clerk for failing to do their job?
I think the question is whether or not there is a legitimate basis for enforcing a secret lien. I mean, here, now counsel has said that everyone who's thinking about making a loan to a prospective business person has to go out and talk to every other party that has a judgment against that person, or if the Court of Appeals opinion would be affirmed, then everyone will have to presume from now on that anyone who has a judgment has a lien that goes on forever, because the Court of Appeals says it doesn't matter that there was no filing, and moreover, the lien attaches to future property for years as long as the judgment remains unsatisfied. In this case, Hartland looked at the CCAP and looked at this file, and what it showed was that this was a foreclosure action by Town Bank against Mr. Brophy. At the same time that Town Bank initially obtained a judgment against Mr. Brophy individually, it obtained two foreclosure judgments. The amount of the judgment was reduced from about $1.7 million initially, I think, in February of 2006 to $225,000 in October of 2006 by virtue of the fact that the proceeds from the sheriff's sale and the foreclosure were used to applied in reduction in the amount of the monetary judgment. So anyone looking at that file would say, aha, this is a foreclosure lawsuit. There was nothing of record showing that anyone had pursued supplementary proceedings whatsoever, which is distinctly different than what happened in Badger Lines. In Badger Lines, all three orders were filed, and what this court said was there was nothing more public about the turnover order and the appointment of a receiver order, there was nothing more public about that than the fact that the original order on the judgment debtor to appear, where all three orders were filed, There was nothing more public about the later two. And that's distinctly different. And in our case, there was nothing filed. In Badger Lines, there were all three orders filed. In the Hilde case, this court relied on the Hilde case. In the Hilde case, the court order was also a matter of public record. And that clearly is distinguishable from our case. I think as far as equities are concerned, Heartland had no notice. And certainly Heartland would not have been making any loan to Brophy if they knew that there was this potential lien sitting out there just by virtue of a judgment being taken against Mr. Brophy. There are many, many, many judgments and judgment creditors who don't bother to do supplementary proceedings. And based on the Court of Appeals opinion in this case, now everyone will have to assume that everyone has a receiver's lien.
Well, maybe it's a good idea that the creditors go after the debtor as promptly as possible and finish it up and clean it up and get the debtor off the hook and get the money paid and not let it sit there for year after year after year. So it becomes a race notice.
But there should be notice.
Well, there's notice that there's a judgment docketed. And you didn't have notice here of the service because an error was made.
But if you look at the CCAP, on that foreclosure action, it's a foreclosure action. There were two properties foreclosed on, and the judgment was incidental.
But you didn't know there was another proceeding. But you knew it could have been another proceeding, a supplemental proceeding,
yes,
right?
But the statute says that if there is such a proceeding, it shall be filed.
No, but whose fault was it that it wasn't filed?
Well, it wasn't Heartland's fault.
That's true. So you got two other choices, right? You eliminated ones, you got two others. Right?
I don't think
supplemental commissioner or the town.
In equity, I don't think this court should enforce what is really a secret lien.
Well, you know, when you say secret, that
non-public.
I immediately react, oh, we got to have transparency. I understand that. But the question is, you really do have notice as soon as you have a judgment against a debtor that a whole variety of things could be happening on personal property that doesn't have the kind of visibility that real estate has.
Well, there's a statute that gives them a judgment lien on real property, but there isn't a statute that gives them
a lien
on personal property.
That's right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. And on behalf of the court, I want to thank both Attorney Hutchinson and Attorney Cesar on this argument on judgment receiver liens and priorities. A case that hasn't come up in the court, at least to my recollection, since the last one, right? That's easy. Then I don't have to remember the name. Badger Line.
That's really precise.
That's precise and totally accurate. Badger Line. And we'll have another one on a different issue, but in the same area of law this afternoon. So that ends 11AP 2774, Attorneys Title Guarantee Fund, Inc. versus Town Bank. The court's in recess until 1:30 when it will hear the last case of today. We are in recess.